Blog Talk Radio.
Give my promo code.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. Jay Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when I and on the air.
This is MJ Network. MJ is in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, who got me started in this whole radio thing. And today we are going to have so much fun because we have the author of The Cunning and soon to come out next Wednesday, Fatal Obsession. And you want to read about McCabe because he's one of my new favorite characters. Now I'm addicted again. This is not good. I mean, really, seriously, it's great.
I think this is seriously good.
Yeah, seriously, let me tell you, I've been reading so many books that I'm losing count at, as a matter of fact. So we have James Heyman here, and because Fran walked up to him at the Phila Fest and said, "How come I never reviewed your book?" See what happens? This is what happens to me, which is good. So how are you this morning?
I'm terrific this morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm hanging in there, really? Okay.
Good. Well, I'm delighted to be your guest today, so let me say that.
Oh, I'm glad you're here, too. So we have Detective Mike McCabe, and he moved from top homicide job to NYPD in Portland, Maine, to leave his failed marriage, poor guy, and suspicions of wrongdoing. And his little 13-year-old girl, who I love, who happens to have the same name as my niece, Casey, lives with him, and I think that's really cool. And he's got a girlfriend, Maggie Savage, and we'll talk more about her in both books soon. So how did you come up with this particular character? And those of you that, you know, I would watch my body parts with this guy, because seriously, it's dangerous. So tell us, my friend has just had heart surgery, and I go like, Maria, you sure yours is in your body anymore? So tell us the backstory and why he left New York. And I don't blame him, but what can I say?
Well, McCabe, like me, I was born in Brooklyn. McCabe was born in the Bronx. So we're both native New Yorkers, and we were both brought up in the city. From there, we took pretty different routes. But he initially, as a young man, wanted to be a movie director. So he went to NYU Film School, where he met a beautiful young actress named Sandy, and they had a romance. And sadly, because Casey was the result, Sandy mm-hmm. became pregnant, and McCabe was forced to drop out of school to make a living, and so he joined what he considered to be the family business, the New York Police Department, because his brother was a New York City cop, his father had been a New York City cop, and even his grandfather had been a New York City cop, which is something that's true about a lot of police families. It goes generation to generation to generation.
It's a very difficult vocation. So he works with Maggie. And when we get to the book that's coming out in next week, Fatal Obsession, you'll get to know her even better. And she's really cool. So how did you start a relationship?
Characters.
Yeah, mine too. You know, this is really bad because now I have to read all the McCabe series. And I'm going to have to read about
her. Well, I think that's
wonderful. It doesn't happen too often. I won't
tell all your friends,
not
just on radio.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. You see, this is what happens when I walk up to an author at the Thrill Fest and say, like, can I have your book? I do that. I don't do that too often. Yeah, I do it all the time. So,
well, I think
Maggie
I sort of
Savage.
Trapped you into it, Fran, if we weren't going to be honest.
You did.
I
know you did.
No, come here.
And Bruce Coffin was sitting next to you, so he sort of said, looked at me, go like that. Yeah, he's coming on October 30th, and his new book is coming out that particular day. So that should be interesting.
Excellent.
And, yeah, I've got a... I was glad I was able to fit this one in. Oh, before I forget, everybody, happy birthday, Danny Nicole, to my beautiful niece. She turns 22 today. And I'm her favorite homework partner. She loves me more than anything. So happy birthday, baby girl, and have fun. So tell us about Maggie Savage and how they get along working together as partners. That's really weird.
Well, McCabe, as you know, left New York to find what he considered a more wholesome environment to bring up his daughter as a single dad, because Sandy walked out on him to take up with a rich guy because she's more interested in money than anything else. So he took his daughter up to Portland, Maine, which seemed to him, to be a good, safe, wholesome environment, and B, where the police department had offered him a job as the head of the Crimes Against People unit in the Detective Bureau. And so he came up there with Casey. And when he first arrived, Maggie was a little pissed off. Can I use that word, pissed off, on the radio? But she was annoyed because she thought that she deserved the post of being head of the Crimes Against People, and she thought there was a little gender bias there. But it didn't take long before each of them earned the respect of the other, and they became, as anybody who reads the books from the beginning knows, fast friends as well as very effective partners who work well together. And the relationship grows over the series of books. If you start, as we are, with the first book, which is titled The Cutting, McCabe has a girlfriend named Kira, who he lives with, who's kind of a surrogate mother to Casey, and is just friends with Maggie. But his relationship with Maggie grows over each successive book. So for those who... those readers who enjoy a romantic story, it's a romance that grows over time, as these things sometimes do.
Well, if it happens too fast, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't, you know, like too fast is no good. So we have Casey. I love this kid. This kid's great. And she lives with him, we know why. But what is she worried about her father? She really worries about him. And
well, she knows
cop.
He's a cop. She's 13, so she's, you know, aware of what goes on in the world, to some extent at least. And she knows he's a cop. She knows being a cop can be a dangerous profession. She also has been abandoned by her mother, so she has a deep-seated fear that something bad will happen to her father and she'll be left alone. And so her father, you know, her father's presence and her father's safety, for that matter, is something she doesn't want to talk about because she doesn't want to sound frightened, but it's something that's very meaningful for her because he is her anchor in life. He is the one who, you know, she depends on to bring her up and to take care of her and to love her. And it's become, since McCabe's marriage broke up, it's become a very strong relationship between McCabe and his daughter, who's a smart... and I like her, too, as a character. I enjoyed creating her, and I'm the father of a terrific daughter, so I had a good role model for creating Casey.
That is so cool. So we have Kara, and when McCabe gets crazy, she's able to calm down, so that which is good. So tell us about Katie Dubois and Elise Anderson and their murders, which really got me nervous because I was going to wear a protective vest after this book.
It would have been probably a wise thing to do if you were planning on visiting Portland, Maine.
That's what I figured, yeah.
The murder of Katie Dubois, which is very unusual. She's a 17-year-old or 16-year-old soccer star at the local high school, at Portland High School. And... she disappears, goes missing, is missing for a week, and then her body turns up in an empty junkyard, scrap metal yard. And she's obviously been physically tortured, sexually abused, and But most unique of all, her chest has been opened up and her heart removed from her body with what the medical examiner calls surgical precision. The medical examiner, Terry Mirabito, who appears in a number of the books, says she couldn't have removed the heart better herself with all her medical training, and she doesn't think a heart surgeon, cardiac surgeon, could have done a better job. She tells McCabe that removing a heart is not that difficult, but still, it was done professionally. This gets him thinking, like, what's going on? Do we just have a real wacko here who's got this thing about dismembering young women? Or what's happening? And he remembers reading in a Florida newspaper when he was down there with Casey at Disney World a story of another young woman who was found with her heart also surgically removed from her body. This was a few years earlier. And so he calls the Florida police officer who investigated that crime and discusses it. And the thought comes to his mind that the possibility that these women, this teenager and somewhat older woman Elise, were both murdered for the same reason, to remove their hearts to be used in illegal heart transplants. It is, you know, it's pretty well known if you follow what goes on in organ transplant surgery that there's a severe shortage of hearts that are suitable for and available for transplant. And so he follows this trail and discovers that four other people who also fit the profile of being attractive, young, healthy, athletic, also have been mysteriously murdered and their hearts removed. So he starts investigating the possibility of illegal heart transplants.
Well, they're still doing them today, that's for sure. We just don't know. In Mexico and all of those places, constantly.
Well, they certainly do illegal kidney and liver. Heart is trickier, as I explain in the book, because you need a big team to do it. And it's a very expensive procedure. But McCabe discovers during the course of the book that one of the purposes, not the only one, but one of the purposes is to sell these hearts to octogenarian billionaires who have congenital heart disease and need a transplant. But 80-year-olds, 80-plus-year-olds, are not going to get a transplant heart. It just isn't going to work that way unless they do something shady, like pay off a disreputable, dishonest, whatever you want to call them, murderous surgeon to do the trick for them.
Well, tell us about Philip Spencer. I want to say too much about him, but tell him about it. I didn't like that guy.
Well, you weren't supposed to. I didn't like him either.
I really didn't like him. I didn't like him to start with, and he didn't really want to talk to him. So, tell us about this. I don't like this guy at all. Yeah, right.
Spencer is the leading heart transplant surgeon in Portland. So when McCabe first comes across this notion that this is about heart transplants, he's the guy that McCabe talks to first. And Spencer is arrogant, off-putting, tells McCabe could never happen, no way. Tells McCabe to go, look at other things and basically to screw off, go away. And McCabe doesn't like him any more than you do, Fran. So,
no, I really didn't like him at all. I was going to, have the guy rip his heart out, too, but, he couldn't get in touch with him. Sorry.
Well,
seriously.
As you know, certain things do happen to him later in the book.
Yeah,
I don't
want to
do too many spoilers.
No. So we have Lucinda, and she didn't know about Elise and a whole bunch of other people. So she meets this guy that calls himself Harry Lime, and I wanted to keep telling her, don't go, don't fall for this person. So she falls for him, and why does she, young girls that are joggers have to be careful. So what should people learn from this that mistake? I mean, young people learn about strangers, and they think that they're helping them, and he didn't help her.
He
so
certainly
what should
didn't
they
help
learn
her.
And why should, yeah, seriously.
Well, she literally runs into him when she's on a morning run.
Yeah.
On a foggy early morning in Portland, Maine, which is not unusual. The first line in the book, which I still recall, is fog can be a sudden thing on the Maine coast. Anyway, he appears out of the fog, and she's nervous at first, as any young woman would be, if this, you know, big, and he was a physically imposing character. He was 6'2" or 6'3", I don't remember exactly. But he's also quite funny. He names himself Harry Lime, which is a name of a character in a famous old movie. And he's very pleasant, and he doesn't wear a wedding ring, and she's just a year or so before split up with her husband, so she's sort of looking for a new guy. And he seems to be very charming, so they start chatting, and he asks very politely, can he run along with her? And I imagine your listeners can guess what happens next. He grabs her and drugs her and throws her in the back of a car, and the next thing we know, she's in a dark place, alone, and obviously under great threat. But she doesn't know what for. She doesn't know it that it's her heart that he is interested in.
Well, we're not going to say whether he gets it or not, but I'm still, you know, after this thing, I'm going to make sure that they get me, you know, the protective vest, because you never know. I was born in the South Bronx, so I'm
talking. Oh, okay.
And my dad grew up in Brooklyn, Williamsburg, and Mulberry Street. So,
yeah, I was, my first address was in Flatbush, 1002 Foster Avenue, not far from Coney Island Avenue. But it was a little baby.
Yeah, I grew up in a very tough neighborhood, and that's why I turned out this way, people. So don't mess with us New York people. So, seriously. I said that to someone yesterday, and she came up from my old stomping grounds on Fordham Road. I said, now I know why, you know, we get along. So tell us about Sandy and why Casey never wants to see her mother, and personally, I don't blame her at all.
I don't blame her either. Sandy is totally narcissistic, self-centered, selfish, and bitchy. She also happens to be exceptionally beautiful and would never have married McCabe other than the fact she got pregnant and she thought he was going to be a famous movie director at the time. When he turns out just to be a cop, this is not the future she sees for herself, and she starts messing around with rich guys who are attracted to her just because she's gorgeous. And basically ignoring both her husband and her her daughter, McCabe, you know, doesn't want to break up the marriage because he thinks it'll be harmful for his daughter. He's devoted to her. He loves her, you know, as much as love can express itself, and that's the reason he stays with Sandy, even after he knows she's having these multiple affairs with these Wall Street types. But finally, when she runs off and marries one of them and announces she wants a divorce, he kind of feels liberated, but he also wants to get away from her and wants to get Casey away from her. And so, you know, the Portland, Maine move when the job opportunity arises seems like a smart one for him. She has, after they move to Portland, Sandy has nothing to do with her daughter's life. No communication, maybe a Christmas card or a birthday card once a year, but other than that, no phone calls, certainly no visits, though she's entitled to visit her daughter by the divorce decree. But she's totally self-absorbed, a self-centered person, and really doesn't care about anybody but herself. As the book begins, we discover that after I think it was 5 years, I'm trying to remember now. She calls Casey and says she'd like to visit her. But and McCabe is convinced that she simply wants to use her now growing up young daughter as an ornament in her life, because Casey is a beautiful young girl growing into becoming a beautiful young woman. So the subplot, and I think subplots or backstories are important. In all of my books, but the backstory is McCabe's frantic efforts to avoid having Sandy come up and actually spend a weekend with Casey. These efforts fail. She spends the weekend, and he and Casey together just deal with it. And, his girl, McCabe's girlfriend, Kira, says she thinks it's probably a good thing that Casey is getting to know her mother. McCabe's brother, Bobby, who is a lawyer in New York, tells him the same thing. And I think McCabe finally comes around to that point of view.
Well, see, you know, I've been through that with somebody else, and they have to make up their own minds. And Casey needs to come up with her own solution to her mother.
Exactly.
So,
and that's exactly what
Kira
tells McCabe, and that's exactly what his brother Bobby tells him, that she has to develop whatever relationship she has or whatever lack of relationship she has. That has to be Casey's decision along with her mother's decision.
Exactly. So if she can either decide, you know, after she sees her for the weekend, and that was the end of the book, basically, whatever happens, whether she wants to see her ever again. And that's a tough one.
Indeed.
So we have heart transplants and heart harvesting, and we have the murder scenes. How did you, what kind of research did you do into that? Because that's so scary.
Quite a bit, actually. I read everything I could online, obviously, on Googling heart transplant surgeries and going to various hospitals online that did them. And then I also was lucky enough to have a college classmate who has spent and has just recently retired from being a heart transplant surgeon in the Midwest. And so we had long conversations about the procedures and what would be necessary for this kind of thing to happen and what drugs should be used. And he was enormously helpful. His name is Dr. Robert Zeff, Z-E-F-F, and he was a fine surgeon. He was a very, very well-respected transplant surgeon. So I was very lucky in that regard. And when I started the project, I knew that Bob would be available to me to help me out in any way I wanted. So I was lucky in that regard.
Yeah, you are, because a lot of people, like myself, who would want like a consultant or somebody, it's hard to find someone. It's hard
it
to
is.
Find somebody
it
that
is.
that can yeah, because my next book, I'm hoping to write it. I started it. It's almost done if I ever get 5 minutes, but I've got like so many books to review inside that my chair's covered with books. There's no room for me, literally, seriously.
Well, if you want to write it, you gotta spread the seas and make a place for that writing time. Otherwise, it'll never happen.
I keep saying that, and then somebody calls me to help me with homework on the phone, and what can I do? And which is what I was doing last night. My nephew started junior high school today. Kate, I hope you do okay. And I was helping him do his math homework till 10 o'clock. Yep, that's me.
Yeah. Well, you're a wonderful aunt to take that time.
Yeah, well, someone's got to do it, what can I say? And he's in Florida.
That's true.
So we have Lucas Kane, we have Wilcox and Holland. And how do they connect to Spencer? I mean, there's a whole bunch of people that I don't like these people either, by the way.
You shouldn't like these. It turns out they were classmates in medical school.
Yeah,
and
I know.
They stayed friends. And Kane presumably was killed, died. And I will let the readers discover for themselves the fact that he didn't die as he was supposed to have died and is living an alternative life. When the book opens, mostly in Miami, Florida, and develops this scheme for these illegal heart transplants since she has been trained in the procedures.
So tell us about Harriet Spencer, the poor thing. Oh, poor Harriet.
Harriet is both, she's one of those characters who's both good and evil.
Yes, she
is.
We
feel sympathy for her. You know, you said poor Harriet. That's true. We feel sympathy for her. She's married to this guy who's made a lot of money being a well-known heart surgeon. She knows he doesn't really love her. He pawns her off to Lucas Kane, among other people. And there develops a relationship between Kane and Harriet, who actually at first met each other as children. Their parents had summer houses near each other up the coast of Maine. And she becomes emotionally dependent upon this evil man. And I will let the reader discover what the consequences of that emotional dependency are, because I think it's not something I should give away at this point for those who have not read it.
And we're not going to talk more about Kane because I don't like him. And
you're not supposed to like him.
I know, and I don't like a lot of people. And Harriet, you know, you're really not very nice either. And what you did in that scene, oh, my God. Tell us more about Casey and her relationship with Kara. That's a safe subject because Kara's nice and Casey's good, too.
Yeah, Kara is a loving and sweet person who knows that she will never be literally Casey's mother. But as the book opens, Kara and McCabe are debating the possibility of marriage. And that would make, obviously, Kara Casey's stepmother. And she and McCabe talk about it. And she is one of the people who, I think I mentioned this before, advised McCabe that he should allow Sandy to visit Casey. Kara has some similarities to my own wife, who is also an artist. So I drew upon my wife's experience as an artist in creating the character. Nothing like using your own life. People say, you know, I guess the oldest cliche in writing is write what you know about. And my wife has been an artist for the last decades. I won't say how many decades, but I spend a lot of time in her studio, and I advise her on what kind of work she's doing. And she's an adventurous artist. She tries many different things, and I try to insinuate or imply that Kara does that as well. She's also just a caring person, and she loves McCabe deeply. She's disturbed that he's a cop, partly for the same reason his daughter is disturbed, because she views it as a dangerous profession. And while most cops, you know, the vast majority of cops never come to any harm during their careers, in murder mystery books, it's much more likely that it probably is in real life. I've never looked at the statistics, but she worries about the dangers that McCabe faces as a detective seeking out and capturing bad guys who are clearly murderers.
I know, it's like, forget it. I got scared every time he went out. So, each time another victim is found, they're found in a certain place. So how do they finally connect all these cases together and realize that there's, you know, somebody is doing this and they have to figure out who?
Well, the MO, as they say, the modus operandi, is identical. So they're pretty sure it's the same guy.
Yeah.
McCabe basically goes back over old cold cases and finds other similarities between or among the victims. They're all young. It turns out they were all blonde, which was, you know, is statistically unusual. Turns out they discover that they all had the same blood type, which is meaningful. And McCabe becomes more and more interested in this doctor who was a friend of Spencer's in medical school, who's supposed to be dead, but he starts in looking into his supposed death and realize something funny is going on here, so he starts investigating that, and I'll leave it to the reader to figure out or to discover what helps him do that. But McCabe's a smart detective. He's got good,
yeah,
strong instincts. And he doesn't... I try not to let it depend too much on coincidence. I try to have as much of it as possible become the the result, capturing the bad guy is the result of being smart about what's going on. Also, there is a character who helps lead him in that direction. Who's the French woman?
That's right. That one I say this. She bumps into him out of nowhere. Yeah.
And she wants to talk to him, and she leaves him a note. And so she's his first real witness and first real clue into who the bad guy is and what's happening. And it's because she didn't know that this was evil stuff. And when she discovers it is, she thinks she should tell somebody.
Well, before I forget, I don't want to forget, Monday, believe it or not, The Three Shoeboxes, Stephen Manchester, PTSD, phenomenal book, which I used a box of tissues for. On the 22nd, we have the Leah Nash series with Susan Hunter, Dangerous Secrets. And on the 27th, somebody that you know very well, the consultant, T.J. O'Connor, will be here. I snagged him myself. I'm so excited. The author of The Selected, What Happens When the President of the United States Is Not Elected But Selected, you want to find out. And on the 30th, something brand new. I'm going to do a show on stem cell research, California Cures. And on the 5th of September, what better way than Alice Roosevelt, The Body in the Ballroom, and somebody else you know, David McCallop, is going to be here with Recon. And this is the first time I'm saying this. I'm excited. No, on September 14th at 9:30, I take the hot seat. I'm going to be interviewed live on 98.1 FM, 1270 FM, by Mike Pump, and he's going to interview me about my book, A Daughter's Promise, the story about my mom with Alzheimer's. So I have no idea what he's going to ask, but not to worry. I got this covered. So tell us about Thomas Shockley, the chief, and why McCabe tells him what not to say at the press conference. How come he doesn't listen to him? This guy needs a shot in the head, seriously.
This guy needs a shot in the head, but this guy is also a showboat.
Yeah.
As comes
yeah,
up.
I know.
He wants to use anything and everything that will make him look like the big cheese hero and the star,
yeah.
And he sort of has it in the back of his head to run for... to be the governor of Maine, and he's very ambitious and pretty dishonest and very self-serving, as a lot of politicians are. And he is functionally a politician, so he treats the job of chief of police as a political post, as a stepping stone to his political career, and giving out these clues and making these cases sensational and telling the public more than he probably should tell the public, he thinks will help advance his own career. It may not help advance McCabe's efforts to find the real killer, but it will, in Tom Shockley's mind, advance his own career as a politician and as a celebrity, which is what he likes to view himself as.
I think he and Sandy would get along just fine. Seriously.
They would. He doesn't have enough money for Sandy, though.
Probably not, but he's a show, yeah. So we have McCabe is smart, astute, and he doesn't mind breaking the rules. He's so like me. But when Maggie has to take something down, how come they place her on desk duty? And that got mad because she didn't deserve that.
Well, she killed somebody. And when an officer
is
involved in a perfectly legal, but nevertheless, officer-related shooting, they have to take them off active duty and investigate the circumstances around the shooting to make sure everything's on the up and up. And she's only off duty for a short time. But I did that. I made that happen because that's what's supposed to happen in police departments.
Mm.
That's what does happen. I also have, I don't know if I mentioned it, I have a really, really good coach on police procedures, particularly as pertaining to the Portland Police Department. When I started writing these books, I searched around and discovered him, a guy named Tom Joyce. And Tom literally had McCabe's job for 7 or 8 years before retiring from the Portland PD. And he's been very, very generous with his time and with his knowledge and experience. He now has become, since retirement, a private investigator and also a professor of criminal justice at Southern Maine Community College. So he's a great source, and I always have somebody I can ask when I need to know how it's supposed to work and how it really does work.
Well, I have people I could ask in the medical profession because I drive them crazy almost every week for whatever reason, though. So I can ask some of the nurses and doctors that I go to. But as far as my next book is going to be about my grandmother's experience in a concentration camp, in a sterilization camp, I'm going to make it more fiction than nonfiction in case I mess up and make mistakes. But I really wanted somebody that would know more about it. And nobody knows anything about it. It's only what she told me, and it was horrible.
Yeah.
So,
it's possibly the most horrible thing that's ever happened.
Yeah, I didn't know that she
certainly
couldn't have children until
right
she
up
told
there.
Me. Yeah. So just how hard is it to find this killer, and what are the ramifications when a person, well, we had that one, who compromises McCabe's team, and who are they? And what are their skills, and how do they get help from other detectives? Because he doesn't even hesitate. If he wants to know something, he just gets it done. So who are the people that he depends on?
Yes, he's very actively involved. Theoretically, as head of the detective squad that investigates these crimes, he's supposed to just lead others and not get so involved himself. But that's not the nature of the beast. He's a born detective. He wants to find out things. But he has 8 detectives that work for him on his squad. Various degrees of experience, various degrees of skill. But I think he uses them pretty well. Obviously, he's the hero of the story. He and Maggie are the heroes of the story, so I want to make them the ones who solve the crimes. It would not be realistic to pretend that a police department, even one the size of the Portland Police Department, which is about 160 officers, doesn't have a fairly sizable detective squad going after murderers, rapists, assault, perpetrators of physical battery and assault, and so on. He leads them. He tries to use them to the best of their skills. And it also, I imply, I think, in most of the books that there are other cases going on at the same time that McCabe and Maggie are working on the case that is the central part or central plot of the whichever book it is.
Okay, so we have Sessions, Dave Henning, and we have Officer Kevin. And what happens to Officer Kevin? And how does McCabe connect with the French woman? And they want to kill her too. Oh, my God.
They try real hard.
Yeah, I know. They did.
Which one do you want to take first?
Whichever one you like. I don't care.
At the press conference in which Chief Shockley is showboating in front of TV cameras and microphones and newspaper reporters, McCabe is sort of on command performance to stand there and listen while Shockley is going on about how brilliant he is, about how brilliant Shockley is, and also about how brilliant he was about bringing McCabe into the department. McCabe notices a woman in the audience looking at him, and there's something about the way she looks at him that tips him off that she's got something to say, but is a little nervous about it. And midway through the press conference, she she turns and leaves. And on pure instinct alone that she does have something that she wants to tell him, he follows her. She runs, he follows, he loses her. But later she leaves a note in his mailbox at his apartment saying, please meet me at such and such a place at such and such a time. There's something you ought to know. So that's the real first major break in the case. And she was somebody who worked on heart transplant operations in France and has been recruited under false pretenses to help the bad guy in the heart transplant surgeries here. And she feels guilty when she suspects what's going on. And so she gets in touch with McCabe and lets him know.
We have another character that I wasn't very fond of.
I have all these characters you hate. But I guess
she,
that's far for the course.
She's not one of my favorite ones, but she's a typical reporter. She's very tenacious, and she won't give up. And for some reason, she got under the skin of McCabe, Melissa Bollinger. I wanted to smack her in the head, too, but I could see her point. So how come she knows more about what's going on, and why do they have to find Lucinda? Because this killer had a timetable. You know, like you have your homework, and it's due a certain time. Death is coming when he wants it to. And I'm telling you, people, the protective vest, you need to walk with them in the street because you never know when this guy's going to come at you. You know, he may, you know,
well,
you never know.
One of the facts about heart transplants is once a heart is removed from a body, you don't have much time. It's a matter of hours before it has to be transplanted into the recipient's body. So it's all on a very, very tight schedule. And so when the bad guy kidnaps his victims, he's got to keep them alive until he has the recipient in place, ready to go, ready to receive the heart, and then he has to take the heart out. And they actually, in real life, when a heart is removed for transplant purposes, I found this fascinating. It is put into a standard food cooler, the kind you might take to the beach for a picnic with ice to keep it cool. And they literally have only 4 or 5 hours. Any more than that, the heart begins to become useless. It begins to truly die and become useless. Unattached to the body, that's the maximum amount of time, which is one of the things that makes illegal heart transplants so difficult compared to other kind of transplants. Kidneys, you have much more time for. Livers, there's more time. But the heart is a delicate organism in that sense.
Well, my mother had pulmonary thrombectomy in 1994 in the University of San Diego. And they had to do exactly what you said. They didn't transfer. They took the heart out to remove the blood clots that were in her lungs. And except for one thing, they used anesthetic. In these operations, this guy just cut their heart out.
Because he's a sadist.
He
gets pleasure from causing pain. I mean, he's a really nasty son of a bitch, frankly. Which is my
intention.
Frankly,
he's lucky he's not standing in front of me. This is why. Seriously, people. That's scaring me.
I like to make my villains really villainous.
I like to make
them real as well. I have to say that. Some really villainous villains are very successful in books, and I won't badmouth anybody else's villains, but some of them just aren't believable. And I try to make my villains, as bad as they are and as evil as they are, be believable as people.
They are, because we're going to get to it in just a minute. We have about 15 minutes up, but I don't want to not talk about the other book that scared the daylights out of me, too, which is Fatal Obsession.
I'm sorry. I'm scaring you so much.
But I love that book. It was fantastic. And you know what happened? They sent me a copy, and I had a fit because I couldn't read it because the font was so small. It's smaller than my thumb. It was so small that it was... They did it in one font, I think, you know, so I carried on. So thank God. Cheryl's listening. Hi, Cheryl. And they got it for me. They printed it in extra large print.
Oh, cool.
And
I'm glad they did that.
Yeah, and,
I mean,
and the book is staring at me over there, and it's saying, you know, you want to read me again. And the guy that there are several bad people in this book, and oh, my God. But it was really, I mean, I believe this guy. Oh, my God, it was so true, because these kind of obsessions with people could happen. So McCabe is now one of my favorite people. So now I'm addicted to the series, which is, you know, a good thing for everybody, I guess. So tell us about his strong points, and why would anybody want him and Maggie on the case? Because, you know, seriously, if I have a problem, I'm going to call him.
Because they're really good at what they do, for starters. The case in New York, I should mention, because you haven't, that the location of a fatal obsession is mostly in Manhattan. I've moved it from Maine to Manhattan, and some of it also takes place in suburban Connecticut. But McCabe, I'm sorry, what was your question? I'm going off on a tangent
here. What are his strong points? If you had a problem in a crime and he was real, why would you want him and Maggie to handle the case for you? Because I have a few jobs for him, seriously.
I think his instincts are strong. I think he's smart. I think he has good people sense. Obviously, he knows the technical aspects of being a detective, but he's ready to follow his instincts. He's not shy about occasionally breaking a rule, which she does in the various books, if he thinks it's going to make the case go better. And if I, you know, was faced with a murder that I had to solve, I would call him in a second. I'd call both of them. Maggie has got her own strengths, which are similar but slightly different to McCabe's. One of the things that I think is brought out in A Fatal Obsession, as well as in a couple of the other books, is she's absolutely brilliant at cross-examining witnesses and getting bad people to confess to the bad things that they have done. She's got the psychological smarts to get under their skin when she has to praise them when she has to get them feeling good, to even flirt with them if she has to, but to get them ready to tell what they did, to confess. She's a very, very good cross-examiner.
She is, and that's probably, you know, where a lot of people get it from. So, Fatal Obsession is coming out next week. And
yep,
it comes
today,
out on the
actually.
21st. Yeah, on next week on Tuesday.
Actually, it's a week from yesterday. Yeah.
Yes, it is. Because I have it in my calendar to post it. And then I'll post it again in November. For those of you that didn't read the cutting, go on my Facebook wall. The review's there. And so is the link to Amazon, everybody. And if you want to know what else just came out, it just came out, but I read it before, Abandoned by Allison Brennan. You want to read it. Also coming out on the 21st, Pieces of Her, Karen Slaughter. I read that yesterday. It was 500 pages, and I just sat down and read it. Oh, my God. Seriously?
You must be a fast reader.
This is what happens when your mother tells you you're going to read 5 to 10 books a week and write notes and sends you to speed reading school. And I haven't, you know, it's amazing, yeah. And my nephew has to read a book for sixth grade, so his aunt is reading it so I can help him understand it. And that's in between all the other books that are staring at me and saying, why don't you read me? And I go like, I don't know. So tell everybody about Fatal Obsession. And we have a new character, Zoe McCabe. I liked her. She was one of the few people I liked. So tell us a little bit about that before we, you know, sign off, because you know, people are going to want to read that. And that's coming out next Tuesday, people. You want to get it before.
Zoe McCabe. Zoe McCabe, obviously from the last name is related, she is Mike McCabe's niece, his brother Bobby's daughter. And she's a young, aspiring actress in the theater in New York. And when we first meet her, she's playing Desdemona in Othello in a small off-Broadway theater, community theater down on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And unknown to her, in the audience, is someone who has been obsessing about her, performance after performance after performance. And this is in the middle of a series of serial killings in which the victims in each of the killings has been a performer, an actress, a dancer, a TV star. And we have the very strong indication that Zoe, smart, capable, talented young woman, is going to be the next victim. I won't say what happens next, but there's a lot of interesting things that go on.
Well, we're not going to tell anybody, ever. So, tell everybody where we can learn more about you and your work. And next, we know what's next after Fatal Obsession. What's anything after that one? And how come I didn't read it yet?
Well, I haven't written it yet.
Well, yeah,
I'm thinking. Well, thank you. I may do a non-McCabe book next, just because I'd like to spread my wings a little bit. I've done 6 McCabe Savage books now, and I think they've really worked well. I'm very proud of them, honestly. And I'd like to try my hand at something a little bit different. And so I'm exploring plots, and I've begun a few political / financial thriller.
Oh, nice. That sounds good.
And in this time of all the goings on in Washington, I think it's timely. And I'm eager to see if I'm capable of turning that out. It's a challenge to me. I've gotten to know McCabe. I'm pretty sure I could do another McCabe book, and I fully intend to. But first, I want to try something different.
Well, I'll read it for you before and tell you what I think. I do that too, by the way.
I would be honored. Seriously.
Not for everybody, just for somebody. But I have to say, on October 4th, Karen Vaughn, Dead to Rights, guess who the villain is? That would be me.
You're the villain?
No, I'm serious. I'm the villain, yeah. Francesca Bartholdi Lewis is a narcissistic, horrible person that works in a publishing company that loves destroying authors. And she depicted me so perfectly that I told her that she's got to bring me back. I always want to be the bad guy in a book or somebody's character. So Karen Vaughn did this to me on purpose to see just how evil I can be. And we're going to talk about it on October 4th. But what she doesn't know is that I am going to bring Francesca on the show. But I won't say how.
Well, I think it's a lot of fun being a character in a book.
Yeah, it is. It's fun, and I'm a character in general, they tell me. I haven't, you know, it's just me. What can I say?
Yeah.
So, I'm excited. I'm so glad I bumped into you at the Thriller Fest, and yeah. The only thing I was disappointed about is that I did get George Martin's autograph. I stood online for my niece. Well, my niece, Danny, whose birthday is today. Happy birthday, Danny. Who just thanked me for being her best aunt in the universe, wanted his autograph, so I stood online. And then I said, would you like me to review your new book, Fire and Blood? And he just said, the guy over there, and they just, I guess they don't know who I am, how great I am. What can I say? So,
you should have told him how great you were.
I did. I said, I review for every person standing here. And Kimberly Howe walked over and gave me a hug and said, You want her to read it. And, well, what can I say? I tried. But anyway, everybody, the sun is finally shining. I want everybody to have a great day. It's beautiful. James Heyman is going to be back on November 1st with Fatal Obsession. And for those of you girls out there that meet a guy that's too good to be true, check it out with the FBI and see if he's got any criminal records. Seriously. You want to make sure. I mean, yeah. And the other thing you might want to do is, you know, send the information to me, put him on the phone with me, and I'll give him the Fran Lewis clipboard test to see if he passes it. That's what my sister
cool.
did to me when I was dating my husband. Yeah, she did, yeah. The clipboard test to see the questionnaire to see if he's worthy. So I want to thank you so much. He's one of the few people that passed. Seriously, most people didn't. And then he had to pass my brother. That's even worse. What can I tell you? Then maybe we need to have the villain in your book doing that. But we're not going to tell anybody who he is. But, you know, I could see where she would fall for him, and he's charismatic. And the way you had her, what she did at the end was fantastic. So I was impressed. What can I say?
Thank you.
So
thank you.
Everybody, have a great day. James, thank you so much. We'll be back on Monday with Stephen Manchester and the Three Shoeboxes. And James will be back on November 1st. And I sent you the review for The Cunning, and next Tuesday I will post The Obsession and send it to you. I really did a good job on that one, so seriously, people, my review is good. And I will post it with my 27 stars, and don't worry about that. Everybody have a nice day, and bye.
Thank you very much.